You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Lord, send us your comforter and reveal your character to us in the words of your scripture. Well, good morning. I'm Daryl McDavid. My husband, Will, and I moved to Birmingham last July so that he can attend seminary at Beeson. And we've been grateful Adventers ever since then. And I'm really thankful that Gil and Leslie have encouraged me to teach this class. This is actually the first of a three-part class, so it'll take place every other week here in the living room. So hope you'll join us for more. The stories of the seven barren women in the Bible have been on my heart for several years. Some of the women are familiar, and some you might never have even heard of. But as our Lenten preacher Trigg spoke the other week, the stories of these women have been witnesses to me of God's goodness in the land of the living. And they've also opened my eyes to the way that God uses his women, especially the least of us, the broken of us, as key players in his redemptive plan. So our family story actually began in the spring of 2020 when we were sitting on our couch watching Paul Zoll preach a sermon in Florida during COVID. And if I remember correctly, he said that most couples he knew were either divorcing or having babies thanks to lockdown. And I remember that Will and I, married less than a year at that point, looked at each other and thought, maybe it was time to have a baby. So, thanks, Paul. I know now just how miraculous it was, but we did conceive our eldest son, Ben, within a few short months. The pregnancy was relatively easy despite some morning sickness, and the birth was, well, as easy as births can be. When Ben was about 9 months old, we decided it was time to try again. My sister and I are 18 months apart, and I had this vision that that was the perfect family unit. Close in age, back-to-back grade levels, a best friend for life. God had other plans. We got pregnant pretty quickly again, but this time it didn't last. The miscarriage was early, relatively painless, and if the statistics are anything to go by, they say about 20% of pregnancies end in miscarriage. Nothing to worry about. As time went on, however, it was clear that something wasn't right. Over the course of the next 24 months, I would go on to have 6 miscarriages. A couple of them were early, many of them happened after ultrasounds and checkups and progesterone and permetrium and baby aspirins. Sometimes I miscarried naturally. Sometimes I had to have an in-office procedure. One time we went to the 10-week appointment where we were supposed to be able to find out the gender, only instead to not be able to find the heartbeat. There was a DNC, then later a hysteroscopy to clear up scarring from the DNC. There was blood work, tissue tests, more tests, but there were no answers. Recurrent miscarriages, they kept saying. I had a hard time with my idea of control. My body had done this once. We had been, after all. Why couldn't it do it again? I pushed to keep trying because I just kept thinking, this time it'll work. I did it once. I can do it again. Finally, my doctor told me I needed to stop trying. There's IVF, she said. I didn't want to do IVF. If my body had done it once, why couldn't it do it again? It felt like IVF somehow was removing any chance of God's natural plan for our lives. It took me a long time to let go of this. I'm honestly still working on letting go of this. It turned out that IVF was God's plan, and I'm eternally grateful to the doctors at the clinic in Atlanta. It was not an easy process, but it gave us our 7th pregnancy, and it gave us our son, John. Born after challenging circumstances, my water broke too early, I was hospitalized for 3 weeks, induced at 34 weeks, John spent the first 5 weeks of his life in the NICU, but born all the same on February 10th, 2025. So that's our story. It's a hard story, but I hope it's also a witness of a hopeful story. I believe that there is so little conversation about miscarriage and infertility in the church because it's hard to talk about. My story is not your story. Some of us have children, some of us don't. We're not any more or less a child of God because of our stories. Miscarriage and infertility are a plague on the families of God. They are intimate, inside experiences of death. They are windows into the wrongness of the world and a physical manifestation of our need for someone to make us whole. Which brings us to scripture. In English, we don't have an all-encompassing word for the inability to have children. We divide ourselves along lines of miscarriages or infertility or sterility or fertility issues. There's so many categories and boxes we use to separate ourselves from each other and each other's stories. But the Bible doesn't do that. The Hebrew word in scripture is akar, which comes from the root word meaning to pluck up, especially by the roots. The verb form is actually used in this passage from Ecclesiastes. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck up that what is planted. When the women in the Bible are described with the adjective akar, it doesn't necessarily mean they never got pregnant. It certainly could, but it also means that whatever was planted in their wombs was plucked out. I've chosen the biblical translation for akar for our class, barrenness, because it's the easiest shorthand available to us in English for this idea of issues with fertility. But there's a broader sense of hope, I think, in the Hebrew word that does not divide women, but in fact brings them together in their sorrow. The Bible is rife with barrenness. But barrenness also never appears without hope. Over the next 3 weeks, we'll look at the hope God brings in the stories of the seven women. Today, the first three, the matriarchs. In 2 weeks, the women in Israel's history, the wife of Manoah, Hannah, and the woman of Shunem. And the last class, we'll look at the final barren woman, Elizabeth, and the ways in which her story and Mary's story turn everything on its head. God brings miraculous healing to each of the seven women in the Bible. Each son born to a barren woman plays a pivotal role in Israel's salvation history, with the exception of the son of the woman of Shunem, but we have to note that he's one of only three people bodily resurrected in the Old Testament. But these miraculous sons are not the end of the stories of sorrow for these families. Each of these sons is also threatened. Isaac, when God tells Abraham to sacrifice him on Mount Moriah. Jacob, when he's sent into exile for 20 years. Joseph, when he's sold into slavery in Egypt. Samson, when he dies, bringing down the Philistines. Samuel, when he's given away to a life in the temple. The Shunammite son, who dies on his mother's lap. And of course, John the Baptist, who will be imprisoned and beheaded. What's given, we learn, remains, and is always, his. I love the image in Mockingbird's Law and Gospel of an open palm versus a closed fist. If we cling too tightly to that which we are given, we will miss whatever else God may want to place in our hands. Alternately, if we open our palms, we allow the blessings of God to flow freely, but there's also the idea that an open palm allows things to pass out of it as well as into it. What does Sarah think when Abraham takes Isaac to Mount Moriah? Has she learned to live with her palms open by then? It's something I continue to ponder. We also see passages in the Old Testament where the reversal of barrenness speaks of the world to come. In Exodus and Deuteronomy, the removal of barrenness is the state of ultimate blessing. So too in the Psalms. And in Isaiah, we have this beautiful image of the barren woman singing and enlarging her tent to cover all the family that will be given to her. It is no accident that there are seven women in the Bible who are grieved by barrenness. Strong's Hebrew records that seven is the number of divine completion and covenantal fullness. Hannah in 1 Samuel sings after conceiving Samuel that the barren has borne seven. And the day of the beautiful and glorious branch of the Lord in Isaiah is also the day that seven women's reproach will be taken away by one man. I'm sure you can see the relations between the healing of barrenness and the fulfillment of messianic promises. But we'll have to save most of that for the last class. So come back. For now, let us look to the matriarchs. Sarah is the first barren woman of the Bible and the best known. Because she's the first, we'll actually see echoes of her story in all of the other barren women. Things chug along in Genesis with genealogies, broken for the flood, gradually narrowing from the universal scope down to the nation level, until we get to chapter 11, where everything comes screeching to a halt in verse 30. But Sarai was barren. She had no child. For those of us in the 21st century, barrenness is devastating and sorrowful. For women in the ancient world, barrenness was akin to social rejection, a threat to one's life. There was no one to care for you in your old age, and interpreted as the removal of divine favor. The stakes for Sarai couldn't have been higher. Walter Brueggemann puts this in stark terms. The family of Abraham has derived naturally from historic antecedents, but that natural derivation now results in nothing. It ends in barrenness. There is no reflection on the cause. There is no suggestion of punishment or curse. It is simply reported that this family, and with it the whole family of Genesis 1 through 11, has played out its future and has nowhere else to go. Barrenness is the way of human history. It is an effective metaphor for hopelessness. There is no foreseeable future. There is no human power to invent a future. But God calls to Abram in the very next chapter, telling him to leave his country and promising him that I will make of thee a great nation. What a promise. As Brueggemann states, the marvel of biblical faith is that barrenness is the arena of God's life-giving action. So Abram wanders. The Lord appears again in chapter 13. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth. But again, nothing happens. There's a great war. Abram rescues Lot, meets Melchizedek, and still no child. So in chapter 15, the next time God shows up, Abram asks him outright, O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless? God doesn't chide Abram's doubt. He simply says, look toward heaven and number the stars if you are able to number them. So shall your offspring be. But Sarai is tired of waiting. There must be a way that God intends for her to have a son, and it does not seem to be through her own womb. So she infamously brings her handmaiden Hagar to Abram. This was an accepted practice in the ancient Near Eastern world that the child of a servant or handmaiden would be adopted as the heir. But when Hagar conceives, she looked with contempt on Sarai, and we get Sarai's first recorded speech. Robert Alter actually tells us this is the Bible giving us our first domestic squabble. May the wrong done to me be on you, Sarai says to Abram. Sarai's first words are a complaint about her childlessness. The Bible doesn't make things nice for us. Barrenness is hard on a marriage. If you've found it difficult, you're not alone. The Lord provides for Hagar, but he also comes to Abram again in chapter 17 to repeat his covenant, to give the sign of circumcision, to change Abram to Abraham and Sarai to Sarah, and to reiterate that it is through Sarah's son that Abraham will become nations. Abraham's response, to fall on his face and laugh. Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? This promise seems impossible. But James Bijan notes a distinction in this renewal of the promise. God's first words to mankind in the Garden of Creation were, "Be fruitful and multiply." Long before he commanded them not to eat of the tree, he told them to bring forth children. This is the state of Eden, man and woman in the garden, enlarging the human race. But as we well know from our own pain, this is not the state of the world today. We cannot fulfill this mandate of our gods. And so God's promise to Abraham in chapter 17 marks a subtle shift. Bijan writes that God recasts the same two verbs in the causative stem, with him as their subject and Abraham as their object. That is to say, God says he will multiply Abraham's seed and will make Abraham fruitful. Abraham's line will thus succeed where Adam's has failed, since its success will be grounded in the I will of God rather than the will or ability of man. Outside of the garden, the law of children condemns us. But with God's goodness and mercy, there is, as early as Genesis, fulfillment of this law. I have to steal here a page from John O'Linebaugh. He has noted that in Paul's letter to Romans, the Greek word that Paul uses to describe Sarah's womb is necrosis, or deadness. This word is used only one other time in Paul's second letter to the Corinthians to describe the deadness of Jesus. We have a direct parallel then from the New Testament that allows us to read the story of Sarah as the first story of resurrection. The deadness of her womb is resurrected to new life by God. That is his salvific action, life from death. And he centers it at the beginning of the story of his people's history at the site of the barren womb. The Lord appears one final time to reiterate his promise to Abraham, and this time in the earshot of Sarah in chapter 18 on the plains of Mamre. As the Lord repeats the promise of a child, this time with a due date next year, Sarah, who is listening at the tent door, laughs. As Brueggemann notes, Abraham and especially Sarah are not offered here as models of faith, but as models of disbelief. For them, the powerful promise of God outdistances their ability to receive it. They are resigned to their closed future. God's response, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" Brueggemann says, is the central question of human life. How it is answered, he writes, determines everything else. If we say yes, some things are too impossible, then God is not yet God in our hearts. We have determined to live in a closed universe where things are stable, reliable, and hopeless. If we say no, nothing is impossible, Brueggemann says, we so accept God's freedom that the self and the world are fully entrusted to God and to no other. We let the initiative for our lives flow from our hands. What is even better is that God does not wait for our answer. He acts in spite of our laughter. And Sarai conceives and gives birth to Isaac, whose name means laughter. Brueggemann again. By his powerful words, God has broken the grip of death, hopelessness, and barrenness. Laughter is a biblical way of receiving a newness which cannot be explained. Sheer gift, underived, unwarranted. Barrenness has now become ludicrous. With this resurrection in mind, we turn to the next generation of the promised family, Isaac and his wife, Rebekah. The introduction of Rebekah, chapter 24, is actually the longest chapter in the book of Genesis, and Isaac is almost entirely absent. After Sarah's death, Abraham sends his servant to find a bride for Isaac in Abraham's own country. The servant prays to God to show him the right woman, and this betrothal scene gives us a picture of who Rebekah is. I like to think of her as one of those women who might have a hard time sitting still, who's always looking for the next thing to do, the next way to help. When she discovers Abraham's servant at the well, she springs into action. First, we're told she quickly responds to his request for a drink. Then she volunteers to draw water for all of his camels, 10 in all, until they have finished drinking. Commentaries will tell you that camels can consume up to 30 gallons of water after traveling. Add to that that Rebecca's jar likely held a couple of gallons of water, and you get the picture. She runs up and down the steps to the well over and over again to water all of these camels. Carol Myers notes that the verb to go is used 7 times for Rebecca in this chapter, as well as all these other action verbs. She runs, draws water, fills jars, rides camels, all of which Myers says contribute to her sense of individuality and vitality. Rebecca is a woman who can take care of things. Her family asks her if she's willing to go with the servant, and without hesitation, Rebecca answers yes, and they send her off with a blessing that echoes the Lord's earlier words to Abraham on Mount Moriah. "Our sister," Rebecca's family says, "may you become thousands of 10,000s, and may your offspring possess the gate of those who hate them." One more thing to note at the end of this chapter. When Rebecca and Isaac are finally brought together, we are told that Isaac loved her. This is the first time in Genesis that the word loved is used to describe the relationship between a man and a woman. With the details of this narrative, it seems as if the next generation of this covenant family is blessed. A wife selected by God, noteworthy for her beauty and independence, whose family has blessed her to be a mother of thousands, and whose husband, for the first time in recorded history, loves her. So what could go wrong? Again, Genesis gives us a genealogy list, this time for the other sons of Abraham with his concubine Keturah, and then the generations of Hagar's son Ishmael, his sons, their towns, their nations. And then we get the recognizable phrase, "These are the generations of Isaac. We ready ourselves for the long list of names for all the sons given to this covenant-covered family." Instead, just like Genesis 11, everything comes screeching to a halt again. There is no long list of sons and nations. There is just the marriage and then nothing. Emptiness. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. Rebecca's a woman of action. We see this in her betrothal scene, and we'll see it later in the infamous chapter where she works to deceive Isaac. In these spare verses, however, Rebecca is notable for her inactivity. Sarah schemed. We'll see shortly all that Rachel does to try to achieve a child, but Rebecca does nothing. Instead, it is Isaac, who elsewhere is unusually passive for a patriarch, who entreats the Lord. From the depth of his love for her, from the depth of his faith, Isaac calls to the God he knows not only will hear him, but will intercede. He pleads not for himself, not for his father's legacy or the prosperity of the land or of his flocks, but for the woman he loves. In Romans 9, Paul writes, "So then it depends not of him who wills or runs," we think of Rebecca's hurrying, rapid actions, "but on God, who has mercy." And Rebecca conceives. When we read that Isaac was 60 when the twins are born, we're given a vital detail. It has been 20 years since they were married. 20 years of silence. 20 years of waiting, 20 years of wondering if God's covenant had been taken away. Abraham and Sarah waited 25 years, but they heard no less than 6 separate times directly from the Lord that there would be a child. Rebecca and Isaac heard nothing. They had nothing on which to hang their hope. Nothing other than the words that Isaac would have heard on Mount Moriah with his father so many years ago. The conception is miraculous, but the birth of the twins, Jacob and Esau, is not easy. In fact, Rebecca does turn to the Lord in prayer when she says, "If it is thus with me, why do I live?" The thing she had longed for and grieved has finally come to pass, and it is so painful that she wants to die. healing of barrenness did not mean healing of pain. In fact, as God prophesies to her, these twins will be children of conflict. The covenant children who are born will also be the ones to break the covenant family, to divide brother from brother and mother from father. When Jacob goes into exile for 20 years, Rebekah will never see her beloved son again. Of the three patriarchs, Isaac is the only one who does not have other children by other wives. There will be no further generations for him of this covenant family. All of the hope is pinned on the deceitful, conniving Jacob, who steals his brother's birthright and flees from the promised land. Which brings us now to Rachel. We also meet Rachel in a betrothal scene at a well, much like Rebekah. Unlike his father, Isaac, however, it is Jacob who is the man of action in chapter 29. Jacob finds himself in Haran, the land of Rebekah's brother Laban, where he meets a group of shepherds waiting for the last flock to arrive to roll a stone from the well. The stone is so large that it's evidently not worth moving until all the sheep are there to drink. As they wait, Rachel appears with her father's sheep on the horizon. As soon as she appears, Jacob springs into action. He sees, he goes near, he rolls the stone, he waters the flock, he kisses Rachel, he lifts his voice, and he weeps. Jacob, the conniving supplanter, has finally found something worth striving for. Love. Our betrothal scene, once again, is a scene overflowing in abundance, promise, and hope. All of which will be dashed. Jacob tells Laban he will work 7 years for Rachel's hand, and in one of the most infamous swaps in ancient literature, Laban sends his eldest daughter Leah on the night of the wedding instead. Jacob has been caught by the very primogeniture he upended when he stole Esau's blessing. Laban says he cannot give the older away before the younger. So Jacob serves for another 7 years, and he takes both Leah and Rachel as co-wives. And boy, do things get messy. Rachel now, like Sarah and Hagar, finds herself not in a loving marriage, but in a brutal competition with her own sister. Because Jacob loves Rachel more than Leah, the Lord opens Leah's womb. Leah, whose barrenness is not physical, but emotional, the barrenness of Jacob's love, is the one blessed with the security of sons, who will place her in the primary role in the household, who will look after her and care for her, even if her husband does not. But the beloved wife, Rachel, we are told, is barren. Like Sarah, Rachel's first words are a complaint and an accusation. "Give me children or I shall die," she says to her husband. But Rachel has turned to the wrong place. Jacob's anger in response is full of truth. "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" Only God can give Rachel children. But Rachel has not turned to God. Again, like Sarah, Rachel decides to take matters into her own hands by giving her handmaiden Bilhah to Jacob. Bilhah conceives two sons, and Rachel declares her victory over her sister. It is no accident that the wrestlings of Rachel and Leah echo the wrestlings of Jacob and Esau. This is a family in conflict. But Rachel's victory is short-lived. Leah gives Jacob her own handmaiden, who also conceives two sons. So now Rachel turns to an herbal aphrodisiac, mandrakes, which were thought to be a fertility booster in the ancient world. When Leah's son comes home from the field with mandrakes in hand, Rachel barters a night with Jacob for these mandrakes. The cruel irony here is that it is Leah who conceives because of her night with Jacob, rather than Rachel with her magical mandrakes. In fact, Leah bears two more sons and a daughter. Rachel, of all of our matriarchs, seems the least deserving of children. If we think of her in worldly terms, she is as much of a trickster and conniver as her own husband, and it seems she has forgotten God. But God does not forget Rachel. 14 years after her marriage, God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. At some point, despite all of her efforts, Rachel can do nothing but go to the Lord. This language of remembering doesn't mean that for 14 years God has forgotten her. Mark Genolet describes the Lord's remembering as covenantal language. When we hear this Hebrew verb, which is zakar, it means that God is about to spring into salvific action. He's on the move. He's active to redeem. We see this verb with Noah after the flood and with Abraham when God spares Lot from destruction. We'll actually hear it again when we get to the story of Hannah. Rachel also states that God has taken away my reproach. This word reproach will come again in the story of Elizabeth. But the only other time we hear the word reproach in Genesis is when Jacob's sons tell Shechem that they cannot give their sister in marriage to one that is uncircumcised because it is a reproach to them. Circumcision is the sign of the covenant, and so marrying her into an uncircumcised family would be removing her from beneath the covenant, a reproach. That Rachel uses the same word here shows that it is, as we might think of, societal and marital reproach she fears, but it is also covenantal reproach that she has feared. She has felt like God's promise in 14 years of barrenness has been revoked. But with God's salvific action with the birth of Joseph, she feels the weight of that reproach removed. But even that for Rachel is not enough. She wants children, as she told Jacob. And it is in giving birth to her second son, Benjamin, that Rachel will die. As we saw with Rebecca, the healing of barrenness does not mean freedom from pain forever. Rachel, actually later on in Jeremiah, which gets quoted again in Matthew, becomes the symbol of Mother Israel weeping over her children. The stories of these three matriarchs are stories of God's healing at the site of unbearable pain, the barren womb. They are stories of God's resurrection power as early as the book of Genesis in the history of Israel as a people and as a nation. They are stories of hope for us, of the goodness of God in the land of the living, the way that Paul writes in Romans that the same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead can bring life to our mortal bodies. But they are also stories of continued pain, of family collapse, of exile and sorrow and death. They remind us that God's spirit heals, but that we remain in a fallen world, where sometimes that healing can only happen on the other side of heaven. We look to the stories of the matriarchs with hope, but we also look with the realization that there is something much greater coming, something that will birth a new life beyond the veil, where every tear will be wiped away. God's salvific action in history begins at the barren womb, but it will not end until the child who was born for all of us steps out of the tomb and a new life, a new heaven, and a new earth are born.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.